I want you to imagine an 8-year-old little boy reciting a joke and his at his parents' dinner party about the Dalai Lama named Sheldon. A Dalai Lama named Sheldon? At the very least, you have to chuckle. Well, that 8-year-old later went on to Harvard University and then attended the University of Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar. But the once 8-year-old turned adult never walked away from his interest in comedy. And today, as a professor of Yiddish language, literature, and culture at Columbia University, where he also serves as director of the Institute for Israel and the Jewish Studies and teaches in the American Studies program and has recently authored Jewish Comedy, A Serious History, I ask you to join me in welcoming today's guest, Dr. Jeremy Dauber. Dr. Dauber, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, you have been a very busy person, it sounds like, since the age of 8.
Been trying to keep busy, but also have a good time along the way. So, and then this book managed to combine both sides of that.
Well, that's a good thing. Now, the name of your book is Jewish Comedy, A Serious History. So you have to explain to me why this is important. Why do we care about a history of Jewish comedy?
It's a good question. I think, you know, one reason that we care about a history of Jewish comedy is because we care about the subject, or at least many of the people who have enjoyed the book so far say that to me. They really have had, whether it's in their childhoods like mine, or they came to it as an adult or something, some real attachment to particular works of Jewish comedy. And they've always felt, maybe unconsciously or inchoately, that there is something bigger about this, that it's connected to some kind of tradition, or that it says something more than simply a matter of ha-ha entertainment. Not that that's not important in its own right, of course. And I felt that way, too. And when I came to start studying literature as a professor and start teaching about it, I really felt that there was some, and I discovered there was some real tradition, there was some way of putting all of these things that people cared about together. And I started teaching about it, people liked it, and I said, you know, I think there's a book that will not tell people to care, because I'm not sure exactly how you do that, but explain to them why they're right that they care, and tell them the story behind what they care about.
Well, you say that there are sub-themes in Jewish comedy. What I mean, the sub-themes that you identify include a contemplation of power and the lack of masculinity, femininity. Tell me more about these sub-themes that you've identified.
Well, one of the things that I started out with was saying that, was noticing that a lot of people, I wasn't, of course, the first person to write about Jewish comedy, and a lot of people said or, you know, thought that Jewish comedy was susceptible to one explanation. Jewish comedy is this, or Jewish comedy is that. And I thought, well, that doesn't really seem right, because for every example that you give to say, oh, well, see, this shows you that Jewish comedy is really a response to persecution, let's say, you would say, well, what about all this meaningful and profound Jewish comedy that doesn't have anything to do with that, that doesn't seem to have anything to do with that? To try and force it into that explanation would be kind of a straitjacketing it. So I thought about it for a while, and I came up with these various different sub-themes, as you said, these different strands of Jewish comedy that seemed to do a pretty good job of covering most of it. And in the book, I decided to kind of tell their stories from sort of beginning to end, and that was what I did, and it seemed that these, you know, covered a lot of the main explanations. Some of them were better known to say, well, Jewish comedy is about a response to persecution, and some of them I think are less well known about saying, well, Jewish comedy is sort of vulgar or raunchy or bodily obsessed, which sometimes comes as a surprise to some of the people who read the book.
Well, actually, when I saw that, I was sort of surprised. So let's start with that one.
How
did that come into being? Why is that okay?
Well, I think those are, I think, you know, in putting that question that way, or those two separate sub-questions, I think you've really got into the crux of something that we think about comedy, which is to say, why do we find funny what we find funny, and should we find it funny? right? Those are whether they're the is and the ought are very are two different things here. So the reason I think that people find this stuff funny, or Jews find this stuff funny, is because people find this funny. We have a long trajectory in all comedy of finding things that people do with their bodies funny, right? Finding them ridiculous, finding them laughable, right? And whether that is because the bodies aren't shaped the way that we think that they should be, or because bodies do funny things when they fall down, or when bodies do funny things when they are in intimate encounters with one another, all of those kinds of things, we laugh at them. Now, a lot of times we often say, when we laugh at these things, we say, oh, that's not funny. Right, which is really a way of saying, well, we're actually finding this funny, but we know that it shouldn't be funny for all sorts of often very good and sometimes very moral reasons. The person, you know, it's not the person's fault who one is laughing at. One shouldn't laugh at a person like this or like that. But that doesn't take away from the fact that people have been practitioners of this comedy for quite a long time. So we, you know, as a historian, you talk about the appearances of these things and the effect of these things while also making sure to think about sort of the moral register and the moral calibers of whether we should find some of this material funny or not.
Well, when we find ourselves laughing at something that's really not funny but really is funny, how does that impact us as individuals, do you think?
That's a great question. I think that a lot of times if we are conscious about this process, it forces us, and I think increasingly this is a conversation that's going on in comedy, it forces us to examine our understandings of how we work as people. In other words, let's take an example that is in the Bible, and therefore is sort of as old as written literature. The Bible sometimes traffics in fat jokes, right? The Bible makes fun, the book of Judges, of one particular enemy of Israel, and makes fun of him by sort of at the expense of his weight, right? And there's no question that this is designed as a kind of comic put-down of this person, and it fits in with one of the classic theories of comedy by articulated by the political philosopher Thomas Hobbes, of saying, well, we laugh at, we punch down, as is the common, the contemporary parlance. We feel better about ourselves by making fun of people who we feel inferior to ourselves. But to take the meta version of that, then you sort of look and you say, well, is that really the kind of way that we should be feeling better about ourselves? Maybe it's true that we could feel better about ourselves that way, but should we, really? Is that the kind of person I want to be in this world? And that kind of conscious thinking about jokes really can do a number of different things. It can make us feel guilty about trafficking in those kind of jokes, telling them, enjoying them, being, you know, spending money on things which traffic in them. It may make us sometimes change our particular change our particular affect towards those jokes, but sometimes come to grips with our frailties as human beings of saying, look, sometimes we have responses as humans in ways that we would rather not do, and some of the difficulty of humanity is sort of coming to terms with that and trying to train ourselves to understand that this is how humanity works in some ways.
So if we're conscious of what we're saying or doing, it perhaps speaks to our growth, our ability to grow, and our ability to learn as we look at ourselves in a healthy way. Is that reasonable?
I think that is reasonable. I think that it's also the flip side of that is to a certain extent letting ourselves off the hook slightly by saying, you know, not everything is under our control, right? And to say, you know, oh, well, if I snicker a little bit at this thing, which I find inappropriate, I can grow by realizing that on the one hand, maybe this is not the kind of thing that I would like to be the person who is doing. But I had to say that, well, people do this sometimes and it's regrettable, but, you know, there it is. You know, this is part of a long-standing human tradition. And the calibrating between those two sides, trying to continue to change and recognizing who you are, I think is part of what we are as human beings.
You say that for most of history, Jews weren't particularly thought of as having much humor, and yet you have now created a rather thick book all about humor.
Yes, and I think that this is, as is so often the case, the difference between looking at a person or a group, in this case a group of people, from the outside and looking at them from their own sort of self-understandings. The reason the Jews weren't thought of as being funny for a lot of, certainly of European history, was because they were thought of by Christians, Western European Christians, through the lens of their own theological set of expectations. And they went something like this. They said, look, you know, these Jews, the essential fact of their existence, again, from the Christian lens, from the religious Christian lens, was that they missed out on the chance to accept Jesus as their Savior and be saved in Christ. And as a result, they've got to be unhappy because, sort of metaphysically speaking, they've missed the boat, right? They're damned, essentially. And as a result, they must be melancholic and unhappy and miserable all the time. Now, that may be a perfectly sort of logical step-by-step thing, but it does not really describe the person, you know, or the group themselves, right? It's simply sort of, as you often say in the academy, it's essentializing them. It's taking one essential characteristic, a constructed characteristic of that, and sort of making it permeate every aspect of their being. The Jews, of course, had a very different perspective. They said, look, we're people. We have all sorts of different aspects to our lives, and sometimes we're happy and sometimes we're unhappy, and we're just like anybody else in that respect. If structurally we are unhappy in some ways, if that is the case, we're unhappy because you're persecuting us as a result of all this, and we're a persecuted minority. But, you know, this is not a fair assessment of the way that of the way the Jews actually thought about themselves.
So it's an interesting example of showing how we tend to see what it is we expect to see or want to see, which in fact may be a very narrow view of what is.
I think that's a very good way of putting it. And I think that this happens, of course, all the time. And it happens, as I often say in sort of my lectures about this subject, my public lectures, that this is something that then many of us who would entirely reject that notion of how Christians looked at Jews, whether we're Jews or non-Jews, we think about Jewish comedy in this way. We say, well, all of Jewish comedy is kind of reduced to, you know, a particular kind of understanding. It's a response to persecution or what have you, like we talked about before. I think that, you know, one of the most difficult things for any of us is to sort of step back and say, let's try and take as much as possible our lenses off, and let's let the other person, group, whatever, tell us what they find funny, meaningful, important, etc. And that's a big task.
Sounds like a use of what is one of my favorite words, is the use of true curiosity.
True curiosity? Yes, I think that's right. And I think the true there does a lot of great work, because it's really saying, I'm not going to be led by, you know, my understanding of what the outcome is going to be in advance. I'm actually going to let the other thing dictate whither it will, and I'll be interested in however it goes. And that's always a very important characteristic. And I think it's, you know, it's interesting writing this book where you sort of say, well, first, what I'm going to do is find as much of the funny stuff as I can, and then I'm going to try and figure out what the categories are, as opposed to, you know, looking at the previous work and saying, well, here are these categories, and then kind of trying to fit them into these different strands or something like that.
So a really interesting shift, even in how you approach the book versus perhaps some other books that have been written about comedy. You talk about the Book of Esther as the first work of Jewish literature to deal with anti-Semitism. Say more about that.
Yeah, I think that you know, the Book of Esther, which comes, you know, at the end of the Bible, at the end of the Hebrew Bible, historically speaking, is a very important book for Jewish history and of course for Jewish comedy, because it is one of the first books of Jewish literature that deals with the Jews in a way that is recognizable to us today, which is to say, as a minority in diaspora, surrounded by a larger group that can be very hostile, can range from being sort of friendly and supportive to genocidally exterminative. And that is the situation in which the Jews have all too often found themselves over the last 2,000 years. And the Book of Esther sort of gives a sense of how Jews might be able to navigate this, not only in terms of what the actual actions, but their kind of understanding of how to react to those actions. So as the old joke goes, if the ethos of every Jewish holiday is they tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat, that is a perfect embodiment in the Book of Esther.
And you know, even as you say that, they tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. I mean, there is something humorous about that. There's something sad about that. There's just so many pieces even to that brief little joke, which is really not so little at all.
I think that's exactly right. And I think that so many of the great Jewish jokes, not all, as I say, but so many of them are saying, here is this terrible situation. What we will do is we will turn it into a joke, but always be mindful of the fact that the joke is so minimal compared to the situation that what is it? That it's twisted in all of these ways. It has all the sadness and pathos to it. And that is part of at least one very important strand of Jewish comedy.
I wonder if you would say that comedy, sort of in general, in many ways, is an attempt to deal with pain.
I think, you know, this is a great question because it gets to, the answer is yes, sometimes, right? Some kinds of comedy are very much an attempt to deal with pain, and one of our most, I think, powerful and profound ways in humanity of dealing with pain. And some of it isn't, right? I mean, some of it, you know, knock-knock jokes. To take an example, I don't think that knock-knock jokes are particularly would fall into that category, but they're a kind of comedy too. So I think that was one of the things that I tried to do in the book was to say, well, aren't there parts of the Jewish comic experience, or let me put it a different way, there seem to be these parts of the Jewish comic experience, if we just sort of take the most capacious aspect of this, that don't seem to be dealing with pain in any particular way. So I don't want to try and shoehorn them into that. I want to say, well, is there another category that explains them better? One of them, for example, is just the simple delight that intellectual, textually minded Jews had with wordplay. And that doesn't seem to be about pain at all. It just seems to be with a delight in the world of text that they're in.
Just sort of playing with words.
Exactly. Yeah.
Folks.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, go on.
Folks, you're listening to Jeremy Dauber right here on Mind Talk, the author of Jewish Comedy, A Serious History. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back, and probably we'll be back with a couple of jokes. So don't go away. Thank you. Jeremy Dauber, author of Jewish Comedy, A Serious History, you say in the very beginning of your book that you can't start a book on Jewish humor without a joke, and then you give a joke. I'm going to ask you to share that joke with the listeners.
Okay, so this is a joke that often when I talk about it in lectures, I say, you know, what makes this a Jewish joke? I'll tell you the joke, and then I say, well, what makes this a Jewish joke? And it is a joke about herring. And you have these two Jews, and they're sitting next to each other, and one of them says, I've got a joke for you. He says, what is green and nailed to the wall and whistles? The other one thinks for a minute, and he says, well, you know, look, I give up. And he says, it's a herring. And the other one says, well, a herring isn't green. And he says, well, you know, how hard is it to paint the herring green? You just take some green paint, you take a herring, there you go, it's green. He says, all right, but it's not nailed to the wall. And he says, well, I mean, again, how hard is that? You get a hammer, you get a nail, you get a herring, you get a wall, you just put them all together, and boom, you have a herring nailed to the wall. And the guy says, well, all right, fine, but it doesn't whistle. And he says, well, that part I just threw in to confuse you. And that's the joke. And part of what I say is, well, what exactly makes this joke Jewish? Is it that the fact that it's about herring, and so it has a kind of Jewish cultural context or language context to it? Is it the fact that it has a kind of smart-alecky kind of sensibility to it? Is that what does it? Is it that it is sort of a parody of a joke? It's not quite itself a real joke. It doesn't sort of quite end like a joke. Is it even somehow a metaphor for a kind of endless historical process? So I go through all of these things and say, well, you know, the truth is that I'm not 100% sure what makes it a Jewish joke, but that is one of the questions that, you know, we try and figure out together in the lecture or in the book, of all of these different kinds of ways of looking at what makes a joke or what makes comedy Jewish.
You speak of a fair amount about many things, but you talk about the genre of the stupid Gentile jokes. How did they come to be? And give us an example and your interpretation of it.
Okay, well, I think that, there is, this is a widely spread kind of almost a mode. I wouldn't even call it a kind of particular genre of Jewish comedy, but it's in a lot of different things, and it goes very, very far back. It certainly goes back as far as the Bible, of saying, you know, people who don't get with the program, with the Jewish program in some sense, they don't quite get it, right? And that comes, I think, from a context originally in which, you know, the contest, so to speak, or the rivalry, or whatever you want to call it, between Jews and non-Jews was one about theology. It was essentially a religious rivalry, and it was very simple. Someone's theology was right, and everybody else was wrong. And if you were not of the particular party's religion or theology, then clearly you just weren't intellectual enough to get it. And that develops in Jewish texts into saying, well, we're the ones who are right, and all of them are the ones who are wrong, and we're the smart ones because we got it right, and they're the not smart ones, right? In the Talmud, so for example, you have all of these comic stories about how rabbis are speaking to sort of the crowned heads of the ancient world, and they say things like, oh, we are more powerful than God. And someone says, oh, really? Well, you know, I have this question. Can you count all the stars in the sky or something like that? How many stars are in the sky? And the emperor says something like, well, don't be ridiculous. How could I know that? And he says, well, you know, how could you think you're so big when you don't even know sort of these kind of questions? I think that kind of comedy, very frequently, however, was expressed only on the page, because in the situation in which the Jews often found themselves, to make these kind of jokes, certainly outside of the very circumscribed Jewish world and behind this scrim of a Jewish language, could have gotten you in a lot of trouble. And so this is the sort of circumstances of the theological rivalry that was taking place that's embodied in these jokes.
Well, you know, what's interesting is the notion that I have it all together and you are a blithering idiot. It kind of comes through many forms of jokes, even some of those that take on the aspect of bullying.
I think that's right. And, you know, in the Jewish comedy sensibility, right, there's always this kind of twist in the tale, which is to say, you know, here are, we're saying that we're in charge, we're so smart, we've got it all together, and at the same time, look at the state that the Jews are in the world, right? As far back as the Roman period, there was a guy named, there was an emperor, Julian the Apostate, who says something like, would anyone think that defeat is victory? Who could be so stupid? And yet the answer is, in some ways, well, the Jews are the ones who say something, and I often call this the greatest Jewish joke ever, of saying, well, you guys think that just because, you know, you've destroyed our temples and you've put us into diaspora and you've killed our leaders and you've sort of put us, ground us under your heel, you guys think you won? You guys are idiots. We're the ones who won, because we're the chosen people. And that kind of humor gnaws a bit. It bites. It's very uncomfortable.
Indeed. On many levels, for many reasons. You say that fox fables were of particular popularity. Why foxes?
Well, I think that foxes, you know, in the Middle Ages, animal fables were very popular, not just among Jews. They were just very widely popular. And I think that really fit, you know, right now in the contemporary world, we are very much about sort of changing who we are, right, or becoming sort of a better version of ourselves or what have you. In the medieval world, that wasn't really quite the ethos. It was really more like you are who you were born to be, and that's basically who you are, and there's no changing. So animal fables were very good for that, because animals had these kind of essential characteristics, or they were believed to have these essential characteristics, and that was pretty much who they were. Now, the fox was known as being a very sort of clever kind of, he was foxy, right? He was a very kind of clever kind of individual. And as a result, he was able to use that cleverness and wit to get out of a lot of very difficult situations. And that was very resonant for Jews, because they often felt, well, the way that we can manage to survive in this hostile environment, we're not the most powerful creature in the forest, right? We're not the lion, we're not the bear, we're not the wolf, but we can use our cleverness to avoid them, or to come to some kind of accommodation with them. And so fox fables, I think, became particularly popular among Jews for that reason. It spoke to their condition.
Is there a particular one that comes to mind that you'd like to share?
Well, I think there's one good one that I quote in the book, but it's worth saying here that so you have this lion in this fable, this comic fable. The lion goes through the forest, and the lion is very hungry, and he first encounters one animal, let's call it a bear, and he says, "How does my breath smell?" And the bear, who, you know, doesn't want to face the lion in combat, says, "You know, it's so sweet. Your breath smells wonderful." And the lion says, "You're a liar. You know, I know it smells terrible." And he eats up the bear. And then he goes to the wolf, and he says, "You know, wolf, how does my breath smell?" And the wolf, who has just seen what happened to the bear, says, "Oh, you know what? It smells terrible. I'm so sorry, sir, but it does smell terrible." And he says, "How dare you, how dare you insult the king of beasts?" And he eats him up, too. So then he goes over to the fox, right? And he says, "Well, how do I smell?" And now the fox understands that, you know, what it's a no-win situation. Whatever answer he gets, he's going to get in. So he says, "You know what? I can't smell anything, sir. I'm so sorry. I have a cold." And through that sort of very smart answer of avoiding the question, he's able to survive. And that's sort of what these kind of design for living kind of fables were in some ways for the Jews in the Middle Ages.
It almost sounds like the beginning of diplomacy.
I think that's a great way of putting it. I think that the Jews were constantly engaging in very delicate diplomatic relations with the people who they lived among. And they were trying to make sure that they could have a continuous existence, in a world that was constantly fraught with dangerous change.
So for the Jews, as really for so many people who find themselves feeling persecuted, in one way or another, the use of comedy truly is and was and likely will continue to be a coping mechanism.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you know, Mel Brooks once said, he's not a medieval Jewish scholar quite, but he's very smart. And he said, you know, if they're laughing, how can they bludgeon you to death? And I think that there's some truth to that, in the way that describing sort of how medieval Jews lived and how a lot of people live in this perspective as well.
Tell the story of Abraham, who was a Jew who converted to Christianity.
Oh, okay, that Abraham, yes. Okay, so this is actually one of the few examples in the book of a story that is not written by a Jew. It is a piece of comedy, and it is not written by a Jew. It is written by a very, very brilliant Christian comedian from the Middle Ages, from the late Middle Ages, Giovanni Boccaccio, who wrote the Italian book, The Decameron. And in that book, which is a series of different sort of stories, many of which are comic, he tells the story of a man named Abraham who converts to Christianity. And normally, stories of Jews converting to Christianity in the Middle Ages are because of, you know, they're sort of pro-Catholic or pro-Christian stories. They say, well, they saw the light. They saw how wonderful Christianity is. But in this story, Abraham's friend is trying to convince him to convert to Christianity, and Abraham says, well, you know what? I'll go to Rome and I'll see for myself. And this makes the friend very nervous because the friend, the Christian friend, believes that if he goes to Rome, he will see how terrible the Catholic Church is. It's full of corrupt priests. It's full of all of these sort of terrible things that are really not a very good religion at all. Boccaccio, I should point out, was very famous for his, what they call his anti-clericalism, sort of not being a fan of organized religion. Anyway, Abraham goes to Rome. He goes there. He comes back, and he tells his friend that he's decided to convert to Christianity. And the friend is somewhat surprised, and he says, oh, I guess you thought that they were all pretty good in Rome. They're pretty good Christians. And Abraham says, no, not at all. I thought they were terrible. But if they are so terrible and Christianity, despite them, is doing so well in the world, it's conquering all of these countries and all of this, right, then it must be that there's something there. And that's why I converted to Christianity. So in that joke, nobody comes off well, so to speak, right? You know, you have this Jewish character who's sort of still kind of looking for sort of a good opportunity, kind of a good theological investment, which is sort of Boccaccio's sort of dig at Jews. But the Christians, of course, don't come off well either. They come off pretty badly, in fact. So it's sort of an equal opportunity offender.
I was going to say it's a bit of a biting commentary all the way around.
Yes. And I think often that is the mark of the sort of the greatest comedy, and then Boccaccio is a comic genius, right? Something which basically nobody gets out sort of unscathed from sort of the comic vision.
You drew a comparison between Romeo and Juliet, All in the Family, and the Jeffersons. They don't seem to really, I mean, I can see the comparison between All in the Family and the Jeffersons. Flip sides of the same coin in a lot of way. But how does Romeo and Juliet play into that?
Well, I think that it's just, you know, that here you have people who are kind of uncomfortable. You know, you have uncomfortable neighbors, right? In the Romeo and Juliet, the case of sort of the Montagues and the Capulets. And, you know, you have these people who are coming together, and in some ways the comedy, right, whatever comedy there is, and, you know, of course in Romeo and Juliet there's not always a great deal of comedy, but sometimes it comes from the idea of saying, well, how different and how similar sort of are these individuals? Of course, it turns into tragedy later on in Romeo and Juliet, but there are some moments where we're sort of meant to think that there's not as much difference as we think there might be.
And with the All in the Family and the Jeffersons, I mean, with those, the effect of prejudice is pretty clear.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear that. Can you say that again?
In All in the Family and in the Jeffersons, again, as I said, really flip sides of the same coin, and the expression and the beliefs around prejudicial beliefs is pretty clear.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, one of the things that is interesting about something like All in the Family is, you know, here is this, and this is getting to a different point, but here is this, you know, archetypal non-Jewish family, right? I mean, Archie Bunker is certainly not a Jew, and it's based on a British television show. But it's created by Norman Lear, you know, who basically has said in his autobiography that he modeled a lot of the dynamics and even some of the particular conversations on his Jewish family growing up. And this is one of these interesting questions about what makes Jewish comedy, right? Is, you know, it seems on one level that All in the Family is sort of the least Jewish comedy on television. at that period. And on the other hand, here we have this sort of biographical information in the background. I think that that's sort of an interesting thing for me to kind of pursue when I was talking about American Jewish comedy, sort of, and how it developed in the 20th century.
You talked about Israel. I don't know that I'm doing his last name justice. Zangwill.
Zangwill. Yes.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about his work on sort of exposing Jewish bad habits, if you will.
Well, Zangwill, first I should say that for those people who don't know, Israel Zangwill was one of the most famous Jewish writers of the late 19th and early 20th century. He was a British Jewish writer. He was the one who really popularized the term the melting pot to refer to kind of people coming into these Western countries, Britain or America, and becoming sort of part of the general sort of society. Very incalculably influential sort of Jewish writer. But he was also someone who was able to sort of speak to British society. And in some sense, what he did was he called them out on their anti-Semitism in very particular ways. And one of the ways that he did this was by saying that many of the characteristics that British sort of, citizens looked down their nose at Jews on were very similar to those same kinds of behaviors that were being done by members of the non-Jewish British, populace as well. And wasn't this a bit of hypocrisy on their part? Now, sometimes the British people didn't want to hear that necessarily, but that was one of Zangwill's, I think, great sort of observations. He was able to sort of look at both worlds and be able to see that sometimes the complaints were not really so justified by any stretch.
Said that Jews, even if there were no Jews, they would have had to have been invented for use by politicians. Tell us a little bit.
Yes, that's a great line. I'm sorry, go on.
Tell us a little bit more about that theory.
Well, I think that one of the things that is such a frequent characteristic of modern anti-Semitism, and Zangwill sort of put it, as you say, perfectly in this, is that the Jews themselves are not really necessary, almost in some ways, to the anti-Semitism, or maybe I should put it, actual Jews are not necessary for this anti-Semitism to come by. They're just simply a convenient scapegoat in order to, deflect the problems with the particular politics or what have you of the country. The country has some particular kind of issues. What's a good way of sort of distracting the populace from it? Well, blame the Jews. Do the Jews have anything to do with it? No, they don't have anything to do with it. But if we blame them, people won't focus so much on us. And that was and unfortunately in some places remains a very common strategy. And is one of the reasons why anti-Semitism has been both so unfortunately so popular as a strategy, but also has been so variegated, is because the Jews are sort of a handy scapegoat to be used by politicians to be blamed for a wide variety of ills, even if they seem to be sort of opposite from one another. They can be communists and they can be capitalists sort of all at the same time, for example.
And you're right, it's a way of creating a distraction that is still very much in play today. But that is indeed an entirely different conversation. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to bring us into the world, closer to the world of today, and more recent comics, and what your thoughts are about those. So we will pick up there when we return. Folks, I'm Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk, having a really fascinating conversation with Dr. Jeremy Dauber, who is the author of Jewish Comedy, A Serious History. far, all of our conversation has essentially focused on the men who have been the creators of Jewish comedy. Any women we should be paying attention to?
Well, I think that, you know, you're right that we've focused until now sort of largely on men. And I think that part of that is because we've been focusing a lot of our conversation not on recent years, which I know we're going to be talking about sort of in this last segment. And unfortunately, the history of Jewish comedy, you know, for most of its history, is the same as the history of comedy for most of its history, which is the same as the history of literature for most of its history, which is that it was actively hostile to women, both in terms of allowing their voices to be heard as creators and producers of literature, and also even as subjects of the literature. And so, unfortunately, there is it needs to be said, but there is not a pretty history of the presentation of women often in Jewish comedy. They're all too often sort of the butt of jokes rather than the creators of jokes. That really does begin to change sort of in the 20th century, where you have quite a number of very talented Jewish comedians, ranging from Fanny Brice to Sophie Tucker to Joan Rivers to Elaine May to many others that have begun to develop, to Bell Barth and what have you. And now I would say that in the 21st century, a tremendous amount of the most exciting sort of comedy, Jewish comedy, full stop, is being produced by women. That includes people like Sarah Silverman and Amy Schumer, although she's not quite as Jewishly themed, to people like Rachel Bloom on the show Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, or Abby Glazer and Alana Jacobson on Broad City, to many others. And I think that really we are seeing sort of the rise of a whole new set of voices, which is very exciting.
Is there a general way in which these women comedians approach their work, or would you say it is as varied as the work of the men who preceded them?
That's a great question. I think that as the opportunities for women to produce comedy have expanded, there has been sort of the opportunity to be, let's say, less of an ambassador to one's gender and more of simply pursuing one's own sort of comic voice in that kind of way. So I think a lot of the stand-up women, for example, of the early part a large chunk, I should say, of the 20th century, were really sort of exploring their roles as women in society, right? And that's because that was part of this revolution of being women who were speaking out about lives, about this voice that had been sort of tamped down in public society more generally. Now, I think as time goes on, you know, Amy Schumer, for example, or Sarah Silverman are certainly people who deal with being women, particularly Schumer, but they also explore lots of different issues. Sarah Silverman's new show really is not about gender, it's about politics almost entirely. Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, of course, is very much about being about gender, but it is also about, for example, a love of sort of the whole American musical tradition and many other things besides. Broad City is really primarily, I think, in certain ways, a kind of millennial comedy and sort of music comedy first, physical comedy first, rather than being, let's say, a gender comedy per se, whatever that might mean.
Some of the comedy from some of the folks that you have just identified could be seen in some circles as being close to a little bit raunchy.
In some circles is what? I'm sorry, it was just hard to hear that.
In some circles would be considered close to being a little bit raunchy. What do you say to that?
Yes.
Is that okay?
Well, let's put it this way. I think that not all comedy is for everybody. I think that's true. You know, and there are certainly people who are uncomfortable with raunchy comedy. But what's good for the raunchy goose is what's good for the raunchy gander, as far as I'm concerned. I think that, you know, that if you are comfortable, or not you, but one is comfortable with sort of the raunchiness or the vulgarity of a Mel Brooks, then I think it's fine for, you know, Abby Jacobson and Alana Glazer. I think the people who are closest to working almost in that Mel Brooksian tradition in terms of Jewish vulgar comedy. I think that it's going to be But I think that not all comedy is to everyone's taste, and I think that's certainly fine. People should enjoy what they enjoy.
Speaking of things that might be considered vulgar, now I want to go back again to Lenny Bruce. I don't know if there's a person on the planet who hasn't heard of Lenny Bruce. Good or bad, Lenny Bruce is a name that people know. He said that the world is sick and he's the doctor. He said, "I'm not a comedian, I'm Lenny Bruce." What does that mean?
It's I think, a very important quote, because it's not just important to understanding Lenny Bruce, but in some ways it's important to understanding a whole range of comedy. There was nobody, I think it's fair to say this, there was nobody who was more influential on comedians, maybe not comedy, but comedians from the 1950s, which was a very influential decade, than Lenny Bruce. And the reason was that Bruce was someone who, as that quote that you suggested, that you gave suggest, put himself first and foremost in his comedy. That is to say, there was nobody who could have given his jokes other than Lenny Bruce, which is not the same for a lot of these Borscht Belt comedians. You know, maybe a Henny Youngman joke would have worked better with Youngman's delivery than if it was told by Alan King, but you probably could have swapped those two without that much problem, right? But that was not the case with Lenny Bruce. He was sort of essentially his own, and his comedy came from this persona and this personality that he had on, that he had and he put out on stage. And that gave a lot of people, ranging from Woody Allen to Joan Rivers to many others, the courage, they often use that kind of word, the courage to put their own lives and their own meaningful sense in their work. And then finally, for Bruce, that person that he put out there was very explicitly a Jewish person. It was not even a kind of Borscht Belty person who you knew because he talked about Brooklyn or, you know, herring or whatever, that he was Jewish. You know, Lenny Bruce talked about his Jewishness. He put Yiddish in his act. He was very clearly and proudly and avowedly Jewish, and that also was part of this personality that he put out, that was him, that was Lenny Bruce.
Now I'd like to go back closer to modern day and talk about someone who perhaps has a bit of Lenny Bruce, but seems to have his own view and his own presentation as well, and that is Jon Stewart. Again, like Lenny Bruce, very few people on the planet don't know the name Jon Stewart. Would you say that he is an outgrowth of a Lenny Bruce, or is he unique unto himself?
Well, I think, you know, Stewart is very much in this tradition of American satire that Jews like Mort Sahl and Lenny Bruce and others were so influential in. I think what Stewart, you know, they each do something different. They each bring their own thing, which is what makes their particular genius. Jon Stewart, Lenny Bruce was very interested, in a way that Mort Sahl was even more, about public affairs, public, you know, issues, and was really interested in sort of changing society. But no one so far since has been able to do it in the kind of outraged yet earnest yet funny way that sort of was an evocation of what you felt was his personal self that Jon Stewart was. Stephen Colbert did it very well, but was always playing a character in doing it, at least until recently, now that he's on the show himself. But Stewart really was able to sort of put all of that into a tremendous package. And one of the things that I ask about in the book is that a Jewish package or not? Stewart certainly makes no bones about the fact that he's a Jew. He also throws in Yiddish words. But somehow it feels both important to him, but also less present than it did with Lenny Bruce. So it's an interesting kind of line to walk.
The comment that you make about Mort Sahl, you say that he was a shock to the system. Now, again, we're going back a few years in time, but what made him such a, to quote you, shock to the system?
Well, I think that before Sahl, there was a lot of the comedy, a lot of the comedy that was on sort of nightclub stages and sort of around was very resolutely not topical. I mean, it spoke about sort of people's lives, but it was in a very kind of jokey, kind of almost abstracted manner. People were not really doing a great deal of making fun of topical issues, and certainly they were not making a lot of fun of topical personalities from these stages, like the president or Joe McCarthy or what have you. And Saul really was taking on all of these issues that were very much sort of these contemporary of the moment kind of adult issues, and really lifting them right from the newspaper headlines. And that was surprising to people. People, as funny as it seems now, people did not really think that comedy, that was what comedy really was. And Saul was the first, one of the first voices really to change that.
When we think about just comedy in its entirety, is there a way that we can think about whether it's Jewish comedy or it's Christian comedy or it's whatever it is? Is there a generic way in which we can think about all of it, or would you say that it's all very different, comes from very different places?
You know, I think that the one thing that I think would be very important to think about comedy, that is a grand unifying thing, is that unlike a lot of different kinds of literature, and this is one of the reasons that I like it so much, is that it is designed very explicitly and very concretely and technically for an effect on its audience, which is to make them laugh or smile or have some kind of similar comic response. Right. If you write a poem or if you write a short story and you say, well, you know, you don't like it, you know, the audience doesn't like it, but I've expressed some sort of personal artistic truth. That's great. That can be a very successful short story. If you craft a joke and you tell it to 50 audiences and none of them like it, then the joke doesn't work. You've sort of failed. And I think that relationship with an audience, that sort of very clear relationship back and forth with an audience, that's essential to comedy, and also, which is not sort of completely separate, to horror, right? These kind of things are almost universal in terms of comedy, and I think that's one thing that brings them all together. Comedy is about sort of bringing people together, at least in this sort of shared understanding of what's going on, in a way that unifies almost every strand of comedy.
It's interesting, though, as I listen to how you describe that, it sounds like in some ways it takes a great deal of courage to present yourself as a comedian, because so much of what you do is really at the hands of the person who's receiving it. If they don't like it, it's not considered good. Whereas if you're writing a story or a book or something that is your own personal experience, as you said, if you like it, it's good. If they don't like it, whatever.
I think that's exactly right. And I think it's one of the reasons, you know, you talk to or read about comics, and there's this constant first, you know, vacillation between sort of a need for affection, right, of saying, well, please love me, clap, laugh, you know, demonstrate your enjoyment, and this sort of aggression towards the audience when, you know, or if they are not happy with you, if they're not laughing, if they're not whistling. You know, as famously, you know, this is not my observation, but when stand-up comics, for example, talk about what they did to their audience, it's very hostile language. I killed them, you know, I slayed, I did all these things, right? It's not like, oh, you know, we all got together very nicely and had a warm experience, right? Because they know that it, you know, it is a tremendously courageous and brave and vulnerable-making activity to put yourself up there, to put it out there. And, you know, it's very easy for an audience to, you know, either just shoot it down or almost as bad, if not worse, not to pay attention at all. They're working on their drinks while someone's out there, you know, opening their veins in front of them.
I don't think I envy that experience at all. A final quote I'd like to share from Jewish comedy, A Serious History. You say that there is a rabbinic dictum to the effect that you will learn much more from your teachers. You will learn much from your teachers and more from your students. So I ask you, what have you learned from your students?
Well, I think one of the most important things that I learned from my students was that norms change. That what we find funny, you know, is, and this is calling back to something we talked about earlier, but is very much a product of age and environment and what have you. So they watch or they read the things that I read, and often they find them funny, but for entirely different reasons. And some of that has to do with the fact that they are born in the 19, God help us, you know, in the now almost in the 21st century. But part of it is that they also are young, right? And they just are interested in different aspects of these stories than I am now. Or maybe even than I was then. And so, you know, that is something that, you know, you keep ever fresh in your mind, both in terms of what they've discovered, but also in terms of, you know, how to think about discovery.
Can I assume that at some point you're going to break out into doing stand-up comedy, or should we put that on the back burner?
I think sort of giving public lectures on the topic of comedy is going to sort of be my limited, that's going to be my limit to what I do with comedy. I admire these men and women tremendously, but I don't think this is quite my gig.
Gotcha. Dr. Jeremy Dauber, where can folks get more information about you, about the work you're doing, what you're teaching, and Jewish Comedy, A Serious History?
Well, if you're interested in learning more about the book, or if you're interested in learning more about me and what I do and where I'm lecturing next, please check out my website at jeremydauber.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at jeremydauber.
Terrific. Thank you so much for spending time with us today, and thank you for a delightful history lesson.
It was a real pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
All righty. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available to you on demand by going to mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. You can also download the Mind Talk app from iTunes or Google Play. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. I would love to know where in the world you are as you're listening to Mind Talk. So do send me an email, Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. Again, that's mindtalk.org. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. You take care.